from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
A beloved member of the EWTN family, Franciscan Father Andrew Apostoli, host of EWTN's Sunday Night Prime and founder of the community of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal, died this last week after a battle with cancer. We talk with Register staff writer Joseph Pronishin about the humble yet profound life of Father Apostoli. And then we turn to the season that is upon us, Christmas. We look at the Catholic origins of Christmas trees and manger scenes, and we reflect on what happens when there's winter without Christmas. Register columnist Stephanie Mann joins us for a historical look at a time when Christmas was illegal in merry old England. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio.
And I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register senior editor. The Catholic world is mourning the loss of Father Andrew Apostoli. To look at his life and his legacy, we're joined by Register staff writer Joseph Pronishin, who authored our obituary of Father Apostoli that is currently our most highly read feature online.
Joe, this obituary is not only about someone who is beloved by the Catholic world, but it was someone who is beloved by you. You knew Father Apostoli.
Yes, for quite a number of years, and so I would talk to him in various articles, and then we would just have conversations, very long conversations, and so on. And one of the most, I think, the most memorable retreat that my wife Mary and I ever went on, was with a week's retreat with Father Apostoli on Paul's epistles, and it was just, I could still remember so much of it. Beautifully. He was just such a wonderful priest and such a great man.
So Father Apostoli was really known all over the United States. He was a spiritual master and leader for many people. And one of the groups, though, of course, that is most directed by him or affected, influenced by him, was the CFRs. That's the name of the order that he helped to found. What did he do?
Yes.
What was his role?
He was one of the co-founders, and for a while he was the community servant, which they call their superior. So he not only led the order and had time for that, but he continued all his other duties, so to speak, and which were never really duties for him. They were love for him, mm-hmm. Going around and giving retreats and conferences, and he was always in demand. And especially in this year, it's so appropriate, Fatima. He was an extremely well-known expert, not just nationally but internationally on Fatima, and had traveled there many times and wrote a definitive book on it, and he never seemed to tire. It was just amazing the energy he seemed to have, and yet always very placid when you saw him, never in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
So many of our readers and listeners and viewers for EWTN associate Father Apostoli so intimately with EWTN. How did that relationship get started, and how did it last for so long?
He actually started on Mother Angelica's show back in 1993 as a guest with Father Benedict Rochelle, and he just went over so well on that particular show that they asked him the following year to do a series, and it was taped in 1994, and then from 1995, it played, and it went over so well with audiences. He was just so magnetic with audiences. Audiences were so drawn to him because he was able to explain the faith so beautifully, so simply, and to touch everybody's heart with it, very understandably. And that led to quite a number of series after that, over 10 series during the course of the years after that.
And, of course, another famous face on EWTN was Father Benedict Rochelle. And Father Apostoli, I know, was often confused for Father Rochelle, wasn't he? And it's something that he found pretty funny.
In fact, Michael Warsaw, the CEO of and the chairman of the board of EWTN, said that Father Apostoli would get a big kick out of that. He would just laugh about that, and obviously was prepared for that all the time, because for some reason You know, I know people that knew him that all of a sudden, and I've seen this happen once, where they say, Father Benedict, and they say, oops, I mean Father Andrew. Say with it, and he would just chuckle at about that. He had a wonderful sense of humor in that regard, you know, and he was very humble that way.
Yes, and he was certainly humble, but he was mm-hmm. also connected. And one of the people he was connected to was Fulton Sheen.
Yes, yes. He was, I was told by the current superior, Father John Paul, that Father Andrew was, he used the word humbled by that, and he never got over that sense of humility that he was ordained by Fulton Sheen. And he became an expert on Fulton Sheen and loved to quote him as many times as he could, or even in our private conversations, he would say, well, you know, as Fulton Sheen would say, and it would fit perfectly, just like, a teeny bit of a homily, but on a personal level. And it was just wonderful to hear that. And, of course, he became the vice postulator for Fulton Sheen's cause until just extremely recently, and when he had to give that all up shortly, beginning in November, actually. That had to be put aside when he was in his final stages of his illness. But he was very promoting Fulton Sheen's cause, and he would have loved to have seen his beatification and obviously canonization before he died, but I'm sure he'll, see it from heaven, I would think.
We certainly hope so. Well, Joe, we will keep watch of your blog for funeral arrangements, and hopefully soon we will know when the funeral will take place and whether or not people can view it from EWTN. We hope that's the case. But mm-hmm. yes, we'll stay tuned. But before we end this, I'd like to talk about your Christmas column that you wrote for the Register, where Christmas is upon us. And you wrote a wonderful piece about some of the symbols of Christmas. These symbols are a part of our lives, and we don't even know where they came from. And the one that I've been trying to explain to my son is the purpose, the meaning of evergreen trees, and you wrote about Christmas trees. So where does that come from? Where does Christmas tree come from?
Oh, that has a long history. It actually started with St. Boniface in Germany. But this was back in the 8th century, and the Pope had sent Boniface to convert to the pagans in Germany, the Germanic people at that time. He went, converted them, went back to report to the Pope, and then the Pope sent him back again to check. He checked, and the people had returned to their pagan ways. So he got there just on Christmas Eve. They were ready to sacrifice a child to their pagan gods there by their sacred tree. They considered a sacred tree. Boniface grabbed an axe, swung it at the tree, and before he, with just one clip, and a wind came up and knocked the entire tree roots and all over. So the people were shocked. Boniface pointed to a fir tree there and told them to take that home and decorate that, as the wood was a sign of peace. The granary was a sign of endless life. And the point of the tree, the evergreen tree, points up to heaven. He said, let this be called the tree of the Christ child, and gather about that in your homes.
Joe, I have a funny story about tree. So evergreen, I'm telling my 3-year-old son, okay, we're learning about evergreen, the meaning of everlasting life, whatever you can tell a 3-year-old. So we see a tree out on the streets lit up in blue, and he goes, Mom, look, an ever-blue tree.
Oh, that is cute.
But speaking about another color, red, a color of Christmas, of course, there's a wonderful story about poinsettias, too.
Yes, it's a legend. It appears in slightly different ways, but it's all the same, practically. And it's the story of a little poor boy in Mexico who, and some retellings say it's a girl, went to church, and he was very, very sad because very poor. He had no gift to bring the Christ child, so he was afraid to even enter church, but he only knelt down outside and looking inside, looking through the door, and praying with great fervor and tears rolling out of his eyes that he wanted to give Jesus some present. And all of a sudden, this greenery sprung up at his feet. And the plant was had a gorgeous blooms of red, dazzling red, and of course we know this now as the poinsettia. And the story goes, his prayers were answered, and he just took some of this, he broke some of these off and brought it happily into church and put it at the foot of the Christ child in the manger. And since then, from that moment, the plant spread all over the country, and then it was eventually brought to the United States and become recognized as our traditional Christmas flower.
Yeah, well, Joe, the Vatican just created the nativity scene for this year, and of course, every year has a very special message. What is the origin of the creche that the Vatican, of course, is so famous for?
The creche dates back to, there were pictures of the nativity back, they were found in one of the catacombs, but the creche itself dates back to somebody we all know very well, or have heard of anyway, that's St. Francis himself, St. Francis of Assisi. And the year was 1223, and he wanted to recreate the manger scene, the scene of Christ in the being born in the stable, as closely as possible, the way he understood it. So he asked a friend he knew, a man he knew in the town of Greccio, to please bring in, you know, prepare a stable, bring in an ox, bring in an ass there, and a manger with hay. And then he had all his friars at that time and the people of the townspeople on New Year, on Christmas Eve come with lighted candles to the stable, and there they had mass and over the manger, and celebrated Christ's birth that way. So he's the one who is responsible for our traditional manger or creche scenes.
Well, Joe has written also about the 12 days of Christmas and other wonderful symbols of the Christmas holidays that really have a Catholic origin. So I suggest you go to ncregister.com and take a look at that, but also look at Joe's blog, Keep Watch, for the funeral arrangements of Father Apostoli. When we come back, we'll be joined by Register contributor Stephanie Mann to talk about the history of Christmas in England and the USA. There's a lot more than Ebenezer Scrooge and Santa to talk about. This is Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter. And I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
This is Dan Burke, host of Divine Intimacy Radio. Jesus Christ, God made flesh, was born among us to redeem us, to befriend us, and to lead us to heaven. Don't let Advent or Christmas pass you by without taking time to reflect on the greatest gift ever given to mankind, ever given to you. God's blessings to you and yours this Advent and Christmas from Divine Intimacy Radio and the entire EWTN family.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. We think of England as the place that has always known how to celebrate Christmas. But Register contributor Stephanie Mann will tell us a different story. Stephanie, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you again.
It's always great to have your historical perspective on the liturgical seasons. And of course, right now we are preparing for Christmas. It's Advent, and we are getting our homes and our hearts ready for the celebration of Christ's birth. And of course, to do so, you wrote a piece that is chronicling Christmas in our cultural understanding, particularly in our English heritage. He wrote a piece that's titled, Just Like Narnia, Winter Without Christmas. And this piece goes through a time of history when Christmas was banished from England, from their cultural celebrations. What was going on at the time?
Well, there'd been a civil war between the monarch, Charles I, and Parliament, won. Charles I was beheaded, and there was they called the period of the interregnum, and there was different ruling structures. But mainly what would happen was that the Puritans, who had been wanting the Church of England to become more purified since the days of Elizabeth I, had come into power. And one of the things that they instituted was the forbidding of the celebration of Christmas. December 25th would just be another day, and in fact, if the Parliament had decided that it should be a feast day, they basically had set up a theocracy, a day of fasting, then you did not celebrate Christmas on December 25th. You fasted. If December 25th didn't fall on a Sunday, you didn't go to church. And so they just wanted to eliminate Christmas because they did not believe it was a biblical holiday or holy day to be celebrated from the calendar of England.
You know, when I read this article and I thought about this winter without Christmas, I kind of thought a little bit about today, really, because we do see sort of threats to Christmas today. What are some of the signs of this continued threat to Christmas?
Well, I think one thing is that Christmas is thought of as just in some ways, it's not very a religious holiday at all, but a consumer holiday, a day for buying gifts and receiving gifts and preparing for Christmas in that way, or outdoing your neighbors in your festive decorations or the kind of meals you serve or the kind of parties you have, and not really focusing on the true aspect of Christmas. I think that's one of the things that's happened. And then, of course, we've had the different problems with people saying you shouldn't say Merry Christmas because you may offend someone, so you should just say Happy Holidays and those kind of things that have also shown the signs that Christmas is on the one hand kind of a secular holiday, and on the other, Jesus isn't very welcome in the midst of that secular celebration.
Yeah, and I know that the driving force for that abolition of Christmas, so to speak, in England was Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell. Of course, anyone who's familiar with Catholic history knows the atrocities that he committed. But this also extended to the colonies, didn't it?
Yes, because, of course, the Puritans came to the British colonies, especially during the reign of Charles I. They started emigrating here because they wanted to get away from the his religious policies, which they thought were just too Catholic. They were Anglican. He was the head of the Church of England, and he wanted the Church of England to be the true church. He wasn't a Catholic either, but they just saw his policies and practices and religion were too Catholic, and so they started coming to these shores. And where Puritans ruled in the original 13 colonies, Christmas would not be celebrated. It'd be the same thing. And in fact, in Boston, it was banned in Boston, as the phrase used to be, and there was actually a fine. If you were caught publicly celebrating Christmas, you could be fined 5 shillings. And so that law remained on the books until 1681, until the reestablishment of the monarchy. So there was also kind of a connection building up between Christmas and the monarchy, but just the fact that they objected to Christmas because it was a Catholic holiday. They knew what the word meant. It means, you know, Christ Mass, if you mispronounce it. But and they thought that there was just too much fun. There was too much revelry, and it sometimes became violent because of some of the practices of drinking and of partying, that they didn't like those two aspects of the celebration of Christmas.
You know, right, currently there is a movie out that is chronicling, I guess, the reinvention of Christmas. It's titled The Man Who Invented Christmas. And, of course, this is about Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
Why is he credited in this film as the person who invented Christmas?
He wrote actually wrote several Christmas stories, but the one that's best known is called A Christmas Carol. And It's been filmed numerous times, and I think there's even been kind of an Americanized version of it. I think it starred Henry Winkler that was produced for American TV. But it's the story of a Scrooge, who has to be converted and be told what the true meaning of Christmas is. And in many ways, Dickens' vision of Christmas brings back some elements of the even medieval era of fun and festivity, beauty, joy, and celebration. And so he's very much credited with kind of reviving Christmas as a day and a day of Christmas trees and the Yule log and having Christmas punch and all these beautiful things that have kind of become an ideal of what we think a Christmas household should look like. It should look like his nephew Fred's house with their party and all their festivity and fun. And so he was really credited for reviving that idea of setting aside a day for charity and family and festivity. Again, not so much a religious aspect to it, and the birth of Christ is kind of mentioned on the side in Charles Dickens' story, but it's still, there is a mention of Scrooge going to, Ebenezer Scrooge going to church and people going to church, but most of it is with the idea of two ideas of charity and love and family and festivity. And so he revived many of those aspects and really invented many of those aspects for us that we celebrate so much today.
Yeah, well, I have to ask, what is your favorite film or television version of A Christmas Carol?
Well, I like the Patrick Stewart version, but I also like the musical, the one that the Albert Finney, where that hilarious song where they he doesn't know that they're so happy because he, Scrooge, is dead.
Thank you very much.
That whole scene is hilarious. But there are a lot of they're all very interesting because they, as I think it was Chesterton who said, the story of A Christmas Carol is really a story of conversion, because Ebenezer Scrooge has really cut himself off from humanity. And he needs to become a human person again and take his role back in society and therefore start loving again. And so it really, he is being converted. And that's part of the purpose of those three ghosts that visit him of Christmas past, present, and future, is to wake him up to Christmas and to just his fellow man and people around him, and how he needs to be part of their lives and support them and receive their support. So it's really a conversion story.
You know, Stephanie, all of us need that reminder of conversion at this time of year. You know, we're not in Christmas season yet. We're preparing our hearts for Christmas, and it's so easy to get wrapped up, in fact, in the symbols of Christmas. As you're talking about the tree, as you're talking about the Yule log, as we prepare for the festivities of Christmas Day and the giving, which is a beautiful time of year, but it is important for us to focus more on Christ, the true meaning of the season. It helps to actually look at this history and the struggle over a long period of time to keep Christ in Christmas. You bring up another example of an American tradition or an American story that again forgets Christ in Christmas, and that's the Little Women. And
yeah.
How does that show us or actually shake us a bit to remember Christ?
I think the fact that there had been this period where Christmas was banned, and at least in the those colonies that were Puritan, that had a long effect in the United States. We didn't really celebrate Christmas. In fact, Christmas wasn't announced as a federal holiday until after the Civil War, and Ulysses S. Grant was the president in 1870, and he proclaimed it a federal holiday. That still meant it wasn't necessarily a state holiday, mm-hmm. but at least federal offices were closed. So it was actually part of the American calendar. And it's interesting to think that Louise May Alcott, the combined edition of A Little Women, came out just 10 years after that proclamation. And there's a depiction of a Christmas where, again, it's all focused on family and charity. But Jesus is never even mentioned. The little girls read, the four March sisters read from Paul Bunyan's, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, but they don't really even consider the birth of Jesus. It never comes up at all in their discussion. His name is never even mentioned in a whole discussion of a Merry Christmas. So it kind of shows a way of allowing the holiday without really acknowledging the source of the holiday. And when I was a little girl, I read Little Women. The edition I had of Little Women fell apart. I read it so much because I really loved the book. I wanted to be a writer like Jo March. Well, I didn't want to write gothic stories like she did, but I wanted to be a writer. And so I just read that book until it fell apart. And of course, I was raised Catholic, and I kept thinking to myself, well, where is Jesus, though? I mean, it's a fun story about their Christmas and their celebration, and they have their Christmas breakfast already, and the mother comes in and says, there's a poor German family, we need to help them, will you give them your Christmas breakfast? And the girls do, and so there's this great image of charity, but there's no Jesus mentioned. So it always, even then it struck me, if there's something missing from this story. There's lots of beauty and joy and charity and self-sacrifice, but where's Jesus?
Absolutely. You know, I think about that a lot as we just prepared our Christmas tree. We put the ornaments up, and we have this very small manger that I put out on our table, and it's empty. And so my three-year-old son keeps looking at it, and he keeps saying, where's Jesus? Where's Jesus? And I said, well, we're waiting. We're waiting for Jesus. And it's a challenge to keep my son focused on this little manger when there's Santa Claus everywhere around him. But that's what the challenge is for us Catholics. It's to keep Christ in this important time so that someone doesn't read the story of our lives and say, where was Christ in that Christmas? So that's the challenge that we have before us today. Stephanie, I thank you so much for keeping it before our Register readers' minds in your columns and for being on our show today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Stephanie's column, Just Like Narnia, Winter Without Christmas, is at ncregister.com, along with more news, analysis, and commentary from the National Catholic Register. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. I'm wishing you a blessed Advent and a Merry Christmas.